Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 43, Kips Bay. On the morning of August 29th, Washington's battered and defeated army is resting in New York City. This is a difficult time for the Continentals. They're full of fresh recruits in their ranks, and those fresh recruits are beginning to desert. The recruits that we got are militia from Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New York, all over. These are farmers, merchants, artisans. They had been thrown into a major campaign without any formal training of any kind. They were literally handed a gun, a blue coat, and said, "Here you go." And though desertions were a problem, they weren't the biggest one facing Washington. Where and when would the British attack? Manhattan is 14 miles long. That is a large area to cover with the diminishing Continental Army. So Washington may have escaped one trap just to fall into another. He reached out to Congress. He needed to know what to do. And of course, Congress's response is vague at best. With that, Washington decides that he's going to stay in the city. He splits his army into three divisions. Putnam would take five brigades and man the battery and guard the city. General Spencer, with six brigades, would guard the shoreline outside the city up to Harlem Heights, with General Heath and two more brigades in the north covering Kingsbridge. No matter where the British land, there would be a force to meet them. Admiral Howe, by this point, had moved the British into both rivers and the lower bay, so there is no water escape for Washington and his army. Washington himself was just becoming paranoid. He had no idea what the British were planning. Washington ordered his men to be ruthless with information gathering. They wanted anyone that might know something about Howe's army interrogated. The New York campaign is a dark time for Washington. We see it through his actions, his attitude, even some of the surviving writings that he sent to his friends, other officers, Congress, even his wife. There was just angst in this man. He had been thoroughly beaten by General Howe, and now he's stuck on an island where there is little chance of escape save one, and he has no idea where the British are coming from. So to say that paranoia was apparent throughout the Continental camp, well, that's just an understatement. Washington needed to make sure he had a way to get off the island if the British attacked, and they could not stop them. He even went so far as to approve the use of the first combat sub in history. That is something we're actually going to talk about in future episodes. Quite a few years back, I had acquired a book called Chaining the Hudson, and it is actually going to be the focal point of a series of episodes following the New York campaign, where we look into why the Hudson is such an important river to both sides. What do the Continentals do to protect it? And what are some of these outlandish schemes that they come up with? Because some of them are pretty wild. And putting in the use of the first combat sub in world history is just the tip of the iceberg of some of the crazy things that they come up with. We're going to fast forward to the second week of September. It is a solid 2 weeks since the Battle of Brooklyn Heights, and the British still haven't crossed over. They've pushed the Continentals off Long Island, and they did it in stunning fashion. They overwhelmed the American army, and they did it quickly and efficiently. So why not press the attack? In that time, all that has been done as far as maneuvers go, Admiral Howe has taken the East River and the Hudson River along with the Lower Bay. Not a surprise, there's no navy there to oppose him. General Howe has basically just lined his troops up along the eastern shore of the East River, poising, confusing Washington. Where is he going to attack from? Is he going to attack from Hell's Gate? Is he going to do it from Brooklyn? Where is he going to come from? I have no idea. Is he going to attack the city directly? Or is he just going to move his troops to Staten Island and then go that way? Or is he going to loop around to the Hudson and come in the other side? This is a confusing time, and this is where the paranoia of Washington comes in. Washington is freaking out. Where are they coming from? What are they doing? Why are they waiting? All questions he is asking. Funny thing about the questions that Washington is asking are the same exact questions that the general staff of Admiral Howe and General Howe are asking. Only the Howe brothers know the plan. No one else. So everyone is scratching their head, why aren't we moving? And what they don't know is that Admiral Howe paroled General Sullivan, captured on Long Island, and is using him as a messenger. He dines with the general. He speaks to him, tells him of his purpose. He is to go to Congress, carry the invitation of peace. He wants to meet with members of Congress to talk about a cessation of hostilities. Congress, never one to try and find a more diplomatic solution than all-out war with the British Empire, sends John Adams, Ben Franklin, and Edward Rutledge. They will arrive on Staten Island on September 11th. Admiral Howe started the meeting by thanking the good representative from Massachusetts for the statue that the colony commissioned in memory of his older brother after the French and Indian War. He continued to talk about that if hostilities did not cease, he would lament the loss of America like a brother. Well, Ben Franklin, always the quick wit, responded that they would do their utmost to spare his lordship that mortification. Howe, none too pleased about the sarcastic remark from Ben Franklin, simply put it out there that he could not grant peace unless America withdrew its Declaration of Independence, to which the American representative said no deal. And with another peace talk over, Washington just knew it was a matter of time before General Howe invaded. So he had to begin evacuating the city. Washington moved his headquarters to the defenses at Harlem Heights on September 13th. Washington also began to move his men to the north end of the island. But like he did in Boston, he's moving them in sections and by regiments, doing it piecemeal. You have to remember, he still has no idea when the British are going to attack, so he wants to make sure that there's at least troops in the field that can answer any kind of attack. So he's leaving the island thinly defended and is slowly moving his men. It's about this point where Clinton goes to Howe and presents a plan. He says, "We control the waters around the island. Send me north with some troops. I'll take King's Bridge. We can attack the position at Harlem from the rear. And when we will be able to move onto the island, catching the Americans out in the field in pieces, confused, disoriented, and we'll be over to overwhelm the army quickly." Howe, once again, declines. I honestly, and I'm sure that people are scratching their heads again, why is Howe making these decisions? It is blatantly obvious that if you can overwhelm the American army, you could defeat them. You could end this now. So why is he giving Washington all these chances? For this portion, I have no idea. Brooklyn Heights was one thing. That was a defensible position. And remember at Bunker Hill, they attacked a defensible position. Here, Washington is in the field. He's scattered. If you go up north around Kingsbridge, you know, you catch him off guard. You can stop the war now. Why Howe declines it, this idea, I have no idea. There's only one thing that I can think of. Where King's Bridge is, it is on a narrow area of land. It would be difficult to keep or move a large army that direction. His plan is to go for Kips Bay. Now, Kips Bay has, in the years since, been filled in. But if you were looking at a map of New York today, Kips Bay would encompass an area from 32nd Street to 38th Street, six city blocks, and would go in as deep as 2nd Avenue, which means the FDR is gone, and so is 1st Avenue, and it goes into 2nd Avenue. So it's a large area. It was a large bay. Now, the neighborhood still bears the name of the bay that it is built on, and the bay itself was deep. Ships could come very close to shore. And they had a large meadow there that you could land a large body of troops, which means that he could get his warships very close and land his troops quickly and have them assembled on the meadow right at Kipp's Bay with little issue from the Americans. So that's about the only reason I can think that he would want to go for Kipp's Bay as opposed to Clinton's plan, which could end the war in one shot. In the early morning of September 15th, four British warships lined up for a broadside of the American defenses at Kipp's Bay. Now, defenses are going to be a very loose term here. They had a trench. It was built by the militia that was stationed there, but it was more so just a ditch that they built to give themselves what little protection it would serve. The militia was under Colonel William Douglas, a Connecticut man. His militia was one of those untested units that we spoke of. Though they didn't desert, so we have to give them credit there, they are entirely unprepared for what is to come. The four British warships line up and begin to broadside the trenches. The Connecticut men have no choice but to just hunker down and pray that their trenches hold. The first wave is led by Lord Cornwallis. The first wave is consisting of four British Grenadier battalions, another three of light infantry, three more Hessian Grenadier battalions, the battalion of British Royal Guards, and Hessian Jaegers. The bombardment from the Navy ships only stops so that they don't hit their longboats as they land. When the first boat hits the beach, the light infantry hops out, rushes the trenches, hoping that they can overwhelm the militia. They get to the trenches are empty. The militia had run. The militia got out of there once the firing stopped, knowing that this was their only opportunity to escape with their lives. And now, I don't fault Douglas's men for cutting and running. I mean, they took a pounding from the British Navy. What this causes, though, is it causes a mass panic along the East River defenses. When Douglas's men run, regiments on either side of them begin to retreat, and so on and so forth, as you have hundreds and thousands of men racing for Harlem Heights. Washington, seeing what's going on, races to the front and tries in vain to stop his men from running, to rally a defense, to do whatever they can to oppose the British. Nothing worked, and Washington just went crazy. And now this is one of those few moments where you look and say, this is General Washington, but friends, I can tell you that it comes from primary source material that he was seen that day on the back of his horse, flogging men with his riding crop as they retreated, cursing them for cowards and traitors. And he didn't do it to just private troops, low-level guys, privates, corporals. No, he even hit a brigadier general because he was so angry. This is General Washington at his worst. He's there standing on the hill overlooking Kipp's Bay, and he's just lingering too long. Hessian grenadiers are racing towards him, and he's just there seeing red. It actually takes his aide-de-camp to pull him away. Now, this is one of those funny twists of fate. His aide-de-camp was a young major, Aaron Burr. Yes, the same Aaron Burr that survived Canada and will eventually go on to shoot another aide-de-camp of Washington, Alexander Hamilton. So go figure. Washington is in mortal danger, and he is not doing anything about it. And Burr will pull his horse away with Washington still on it, trying to get the commander out of there, thus saving his life. Israel Putnam also rode out with Washington, but he rides hard for the city. The city still has 3,000 men in the city. 3,000 troops are still in the city. A good deal of artillery and supplies are still there. He races down there to try and get as much of his supplies and even more so the manpower out of the city and up to Harlem. To me, Israel Putnam is probably the hero of the day because he went to the city to get whatever troops he had there in motion to retreat for Harlem. Howe continues to bring over more and more men, and another 9,000 will land at Kipp's Bay. And as more troops land, they begin to fan out. They capture 50 cannons, a good amount of supplies, 17 officers, and 350 men. Now, those numbers are really tough to look at because they just lost another 900 over in Brooklyn. So they've now had captured over 1,200 men. But they saved thousands. And Israel Putnam, I think, was part of that because he raced for the city. When he saw the situation, he raced for the city on horseback, got the word out to his troops and told them, let's go, get out of here, get whatever you can carry, whatever we can pull on a horse, and let's get it the heck out of here. Get to Harlem. We are preparing a defense there. Kips Bay is a tough pill to swallow. And though the fighting was almost non-existent, a couple of random shots, no one's killed. The only casualties, I guess, you put on a casualty report are those captured, which are the 350 soldiers, along with 17 officers. So that's pretty much the casualty list of the day. Howe moves into New York City. He starts to bring his troops over and is now preparing a defensive line in front of Harlem Heights, because the next step will be an all-out assault on Washington's army up in Harlem. For the Continental Army, the flight from Kips Bay is really a tough pill to swallow. And I think the traditional villain has always been the militia. When we look at the primary sources, on both sides, you see writings from men like Cornwallis and Clinton, Howe, and they talk about how they have no respect for the American militia. They're not a professional soldier. They're just farmers that are there because they think it's fun or because they want to tell a story or they're bored and they get into the fight and they run away scared because they're cowards. That's just paraphrasing three separate generals on their opinion of American militia. But yeah, we look at whatever surviving documents we have of Washington where he talks about Kips Bay, and he calls them dastardly, disgraceful. Putnam puts down the militia. A lot of the general staff is putting down the militia because they were the ones that ran away. But we have to look at the militia. We have to look at them and say, why? And once again, this goes back to the lack of training. We've talked about it for several episodes, and I know that it probably sounds like I'm beating a dead horse, but this is fact. The militia wasn't prepared. If you wanted to set up a defense along the East River, why didn't you move the Continental Regulars last? Move the militia first, get them up there, put the Continental Regulars on the defense. But Washington didn't do that. They're comparing the militia to those men who fought some of the battles in the South, but mostly at Lexington and Concord, and even Bunker Hill. These were militia. The Continental Army had not been formed yet, and these militiamen from Massachusetts and the surrounding areas banded together and beat the British back. Men of Concord and Lexington stood together and with other militia units from around Massachusetts beat the British all the way back to Boston. At Bunker Hill, men of New England banded together, and though they lost the position, they gave the British a real pounding, 900 casualties. This is unrealistic standards to live up to, because you have to look, and I'm going to get a little bit into some Sigmund Freudish type scenarios. You have to look at the mindset of what these soldiers were in, whether they were militia or regulars. What these soldiers were their surroundings, their overview of the situation. Douglas is getting hammered by the British Navy. He sees an opening. He tells his men, we can fight another day, and retreats. This causes panic. Panic is paralyzing. Other units see it. They say, oh, nope. If they're running, we're running. And so they run. And this just causes a domino effect. Panic is paralyzing, and that's why Washington could not get his men in order. At Concord, they were hiding behind stone walls and trees. And though there was a couple of stone walls in the area, at least that's what some of the primary sources say, they weren't in the mindset to set up a defense. Concord, they had a catalyst, Lexington. That caused a bloodlust. And that bloodlust didn't, you know, just go away after a couple of months, because when they got to Bunker Hill, it was still there. The British were trying to break out. We whooped them once, we'll do it again. Panic is paralyzing. You just retreated your army from Long Island. They were beaten soundly there. Solid British tactics won the day, and they were defeated. There is no reason why it wouldn't happen again. And that's why the militia at Kips Bay will retreat. Panic is paralyzing, and I cannot say that theme anymore throughout this episode. Washington called them dastardly, disgraceful. He couldn't believe that they would do such a thing. But look at the commander-in-chief. He was whipping men as they ran with his crop from his horse. I mean, for a man that is of the Virginia aristocrat class, that is disgraceful. And though no one's going to walk up to the Washington Monument and spit on it for this one little instance of poor judgment, but it's one of those things where we can look at and say Washington was not without fault. He has been making terrible decisions. And he got mad at the militia. For 14 days, for two whole weeks, the British were on the other side of that river. Weren't coming. You knew that a commission was going to meet with Admiral Howe to talk peace. You could have left that city at any point. 350 men will be captured and put into prison because Washington didn't move. Panic is paralyzing, and it even affected the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. Kips Bay shows you that we are not immortals. The American Army was not an immortal force, and Washington was not this blue-coated ghost that could not be destroyed. It is blatantly obvious that he is fallible, he makes poor decisions, most of all, he is a man. And that's what everyone has to remember. For years, people have put Washington on a pedestal like he was some sort of demigod. Washington was a man who made poor decisions, and Kips Bay was it. I have told you multiple times that he listens to his general staff. He listens. Kips Bay is a reason for that. He has been shown that he made a poor decision here. He should have pulled those troops out sooner. He should have got those supplies up to Harlem Heights faster. He will have to rebound. Howe controls the city. He has the land between Harlem and the city itself. He is poising to make an attack on Washington defenses at Harlem. He is going to take the island. All that stands in his way is Washington and his force at Harlem. And that's where we're going to pick up next week. I'm sorry if I got on a little bit of a soapbox and was probably beat the term panic is paralyzing to death. But I really just wanted to illustrate that this is one of those dark moments where the Continental Army can either rise above it or be defined by it. And we'll look at Harlem Heights next week and decide whether they rose above it or they were defined by it. Till next week, always remember, keep the powder dry.